This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, a new radio show about the cultural hub that was Indianapolis's Indiana Avenue in the mid-20th century. Plus, the reality of recovery from COVID. One patient's story of getting out of the ICU. And the 11-year-old from Fort Wayne who wants to help lonely classmates and friends. But first, our find friends. But first, our weekly look at the top Indiana news items. Lauren Chapman, our digital producer, is with us. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Doing okay. We start this segment with the numbers on COVID-19. And I understand yesterday was a big day, but what does the week look like?
Yeah, so as of noon today, 3,429 people have died confirmed from COVID-19. There are more than 122,000 confirmed cases, and nearly 1.4 million Hoosiers have been tested. So to kind of give that context, over the last week, that's 89 new confirmed deaths from COVID-19 and about 7,000 new cases. Today, actually, the state reported 1,495 new cases, which is the highest since the start of the pandemic. And the seven-day average for people hospitalized with COVID-19 is at its highest since mid-August and has increased for 10 straight days.
And despite that news, and I don't mean to jump around, it seems like Governor Holcomb is not interested in imposing any, or rather, I guess, reimposing restrictions. We went to stage five last weekend or the weekend before, and he's not interested.
Yeah, he says he's not rethinking his decision so far. The state's positivity rate went up and hospitalizations are at their highest level, of course, in a month. And 2 weeks ago, Indiana's rate of COVID-19 spread was actually sixth best in the nation. And right now it is fourth worst. But Holcomb said Indiana doesn't need to reimpose restrictions right now. And it is instead kind of turning things over to local governments who can still impose more stringent COVID-19 restrictions than the state is currently.
So sixth place is very different from 46th place in the nation. But do we have a good idea of, I don't know, the spread of how states are doing in comparison? Do you have that handy or?
I don't have that handy, actually. I do know that a lot of the spread that we're looking at right now is going back to some of those southern counties that have seen new growing cases. I mean, even right now with the state's county metrics map, you've got three counties in the southern portion of the state that are in that orange realm. But yeah, I mean, it's the hospitalizations going up are actually does fall into the category of things that the governor would be concerned about. The main statistics that the governor and the state health department focuses on is the availability of beds and ventilators. What the governor has kind of made clear is that it's not necessarily his goal is not necessarily to halt the spread of COVID-19. It is to make sure that hospitals have the capability and capacity to handle that spread. So I don't think that he's going to reimpose restrictions until we start seeing those ICU numbers and those ventilator numbers getting out of control.
And that statewide interactive map with county infection rates is really kind of a game changer as far as taking a look at your county and seeing what things are looking like. It gets updated more or less in about as real time as you can get. And I know, Lauren, that,
well, so the county metrics, that's updated Wednesdays. So it's
weekly.
So,
OK.
Yeah. It's only updated Wednesdays.
OK. And it is a superb tool to get a really quick glance at the infection rates of the past week.
Yeah.
So let's take a look at Indiana's data dashboard for school COVID-19 cases. That dashboard is now live?
It is. Yeah. Allegedly? Yes. I believe it is. Yes, it is. It totally is. I'm looking at it right now. I meant to do that earlier. So yeah, Indiana's data dashboard for school COVID-19 cases is officially now public. Same place that you can find the other maps and resources Matt and I are talking about, which is coronavirus.in.gov. The state's largest teachers union says it's a critical step to fighting misinformation about what's happening in schools. And according to the dashboard, 1,676 student cases have been reported since the start of the school year, with 678 cases reported among teachers and staff. The reported data shows 376 new cases during the week of September 19th. And that map will be updated on Mondays. The dashboard shows most cases among students have been reported at middle and high schools, and state officials say more schools are expected to add data to the dashboard in the coming weeks.
All right. What do we know about the deadline to register to vote in the election?
Yeah, so you'll probably hear from Brandon Smith on your local IPBS station. But the deadline to register for November's election is Monday, October 5th. That is this coming Monday. If you register in person at your local election administrator's office, that means the end of the business day. But if you register online at indianavoters.com, you have until midnight. Early in-person voting then also begins the next day on October 6th. Locations and hours of early voting sites vary from county to county, so you'll need to check in with your individual county's county clerk's office or county website. And for those who want to vote by mail using one of the state's dozen allowable reasons, you must request that ballot before October 22nd. But election officials across the state have said if you're wanting to vote by mail, request that ballot earlier rather than later. And as Brandon reported on Monday, about 384,000 people have requested mail-in ballots so far this election cycle. And that's already more than double the total number of Hoosiers who voted by mail in 2016.
All right. And speaking of voting by mail, what did a federal judge say this week?
Yeah, a federal judge is forcing Indiana to count all mail-in ballots that are postmarked by Election Day, November 3rd, as long as they arrive to county clerks by November 13th. That comes as part of a lawsuit by Common Cause Indiana and the Indiana NAACP. Indiana law only allows mail-in ballots to be counted if they physically arrive at the county election administrator's office by noon on Election Day. In Indiana's primary this year, thousands of otherwise perfectly valid ballots were rejected because they came in after the deadline. And even without expanded vote by mail this election, as I already mentioned, Indiana expects a record number of mail-in ballots. Common Cause Indiana and the Indiana NAACP argued the arbitrary deadline would deprive thousands of their constitutional right to vote. The state argued its deadline is necessary to help ensure orderly administration of its elections, but federal judge Sarah Evans Barker disagreed, and she actually noted that Indiana already allows overseas voters mail-in ballots to be counted if they come in up to 10 days after the election. So that is the new plot twist for absentee by mail ballots. As long as it's postmarked and arrives within 10 days, that ballot will be counted. If you are somebody who's voting absentee by mail, sending it in earlier is always better, trying to get it in as soon as humanly possible so that you are, one, making it a little bit easier on your county election officials, and two, making sure that your vote absolutely does count. I have put together a voting guide, by the way. I believe the question is, can I vote by mail? That's in the headline. There is a step-by-step guide not only to requesting an online ballot, which is also part of a video that we put out this week that my face is on, which is weird. but I also have a step-by-step guide for tracking your absentee ballot after you send it back. So there's a way at indianavoters.com that you're able to also track your ballot through that process. And so there's a bunch of resources in there. I did a lot of research for it, answering a lot of questions that folks like you who joined the Indiana 2022 Way have asked us. And so all of that information is there and available.
So in a lot of ways, the Indiana 2022A has gotten a lot busier this year than maybe we would have possibly anticipated earlier this year, as we were just planning on focusing on just the issues and just the election. But now we have all of these variables, COVID, we have mail-in ballots, a number of things. And so great work that you're doing on that front. So check out those videos. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that we could actually kind of surely we would find out, but know where the ballots go and how long it takes to get places. So that's what you're looking at in that video.
Yeah. Your county election office sends a little notice when they've received your ballot and checks off, you know, each of the legally required steps to make sure that there is no voter fraud. The weird thing about Indiana and its history with absentee by mail ballots, this is a total departure from what we had originally planned. I am so sorry.
No, it's all right. It's fascinating.
So Indiana actually has a history with absentee by mail voter fraud, but it's not in the way that you think. It's absentee by mail voter fraud in election offices, it's not people who are like stealing your ballot and then like changing things when it's in the mail. It's county election officials not having regulations in place to make sure that they aren't messing up your vote. And so Indiana passed a bunch of laws in order to make sure that that was protected. And that's the kind of that almost makes absentee by mail voting even extra super secure in Indiana, because we do have all of these steps, and county election officials are filling that out with the Indiana Secretary of State's office.
Sign the envelope, sign the envelope, sign the envelope. All right. So we have some good news in our last 30 seconds about the infant mortality rate.
Yeah, Indiana's infant mortality rates are at the lowest they've been since Indiana started recording the data, according to new numbers released by the State Department of Health. And this is actually the third year in a row that numbers have trended down. And that's all because of a bunch of programs that have been put into place, like the OB Navigator program, now known as the My Healthy Baby program.
All right. She is here for us every Friday with the good news and some of the bad, the biggest stories that affect all of us Hoosiers. She's our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Lauren Chapman, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Up next, Indianapolis's Indiana Avenue was once a hub for Black culture. Its musical significance is the subject of a new radio show. I welcome the show's creator and producer. Up next, I'm Matt Pelser. That's in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Indianapolis's Indiana Avenue was designated a historic district in the late 1980s for its cultural significance, but its musical influence can still be heard today in some blues and jazz standards. My guest Kyle Long wanted to illustrate just how important Indiana Avenue was and is to music. He's the host of Cultural Manifesto on our flagship WFYI Indianapolis, where he frequently references the historic district and is soon launching the new show, Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Kyle, it's great to have you with us.
Matt, it's a pleasure to be here. I listen to you every day, so I'm excited to be on the show.
And I listen to you on Wednesdays on Cultural Manifesto, so I'm glad that you're here. So for people who aren't familiar, tell us a little about the beginnings of Indiana Avenue. What happened to shape, I guess, what it became?
Sure. I mean, you know, very basically, Indiana Avenue is a street that runs diagonally through the northwest side of Indianapolis. And, you know, when we refer to the avenue, we're generally speaking about not just that street, but the conglomeration of neighborhoods that surrounded it. And, you know, the history of African-American culture on the avenue goes back to the 1800s. You know, by the mid to late 1800s, there was a thriving culture there, you know, with newspapers and all sorts of, you know, interesting things going on. On this show, of course, we're dealing with the arts and culture, particularly the music scene on the avenue. But, you know, Indiana Avenue was so much more than just an entertainment mecca. It was a business district and home to all sorts of businesses and services that catered to the needs of the community, from banks to newspapers to doctors. But as I said, it is the incredible culture and music of the Avenue that we're focusing on. And that's what has made this neighborhood famous, really, around the world. You know, at the height of its popularity in the mid-20th century, the Avenue was home to dozens of clubs. And it's sort of the Indiana equivalent to Beale Street in Memphis, or 12th and Vine in Kansas City, or even in some ways Harlem in New York, you know, the famous Harlem Renaissance that we all learned about in school. There was a similar sort of cultural renaissance going on in Indianapolis at that time that created a generation of fantastic musicians and also writers and painters and all sorts of creative people. So, yeah, this show will focus on primarily the music culture of Indiana Avenue, which in the mid-20th century was producing artists that would go on to shape popular music around the world, like Wes Montgomery, Freddie Hubbard, J.J. Johnson, all the great jazz artists we think of, but also rhythm and blues singers and early rock and roll singers like Thurston Harris, who came up on the Avenue and had a huge hit record in, I think, 57, 58, a song called Little Bitty Pretty One. So, yeah, there was so much music happening on the Avenue, gospel, blues, rhythm and blues, soul, funk, and we're going to get it all. We're going to tackle the enormity and the complexity of this great cultural history that unfolded here in Indiana.
Well, and as I understand, I mean, obviously, as the person who created this show, you've got a lot of the music that was created there and the music that was influenced by Indiana Avenue sort of in your personal collection. And I guess somebody asked you to put together a playlist of Indiana Avenue music or music that is associated with Indiana Avenue. What were their expectations and what did you end up delivering?
Right. So, you know, I'd always wanted to work with Indiana Avenue as sort of a theme in my pursuit as a music journalist, right? But I was never quite sure if there was enough there to do something, you know, really consistently that would be an ongoing project for, you know, years, hopefully. Yeah, but earlier this year, an acquaintance of mine asked me to create a Spotify playlist of music from Indiana Avenue. I think his expectation was I would put together maybe 10 or 12 songs and it'd be 30, 40 minutes of music. But after a couple of days, this thing had exploded into over 40 hours of music and hundreds of songs. And it was at that moment that it kind of really dawned on me that this could be something that I could dedicate an hour or two every week indefinitely. There's just that much material there. And what's really interesting about that is Spotify, you alluded to the fact that I have a collection of this music. You know, Spotify has a very limited collection of music related to Indiana Avenue. A lot of these recordings were only locally produced and released and are extremely hard to find. I've been collecting records and immersing myself in Indiana music culture since the 1990s when I was a teenager. So I've accumulated a collection of really rare, sometimes one-of-a-kind items that were never even distributed relating to the music history of the neighborhood. So yeah, I'm certainly going to draw on all those recordings in my possession. And one thing I also like to do and have done on my program Cultural Manifesto is, you know, after building some trust with musicians, getting them to dig into their own personal archives and, you know, share things with me and my listeners that have never been released before. So, you know, hopefully we'll not only be, you know, looking back on the recorded history of Indiana Avenue, we'll be documenting things that people haven't heard before and really helping, you know, to really document this culture in an exciting way.
Let's go back in time again. What were some of these clubs and venues that really helped make Indiana Avenue what it was?
Sure. I mean, my mind immediately goes to a pair of brothers that came to Indianapolis from Kentucky, I believe, Denver and C. Ferguson. And these men were extraordinary entrepreneurs. They ran a variety of businesses on the Avenue, from bowling alleys to a hotel. But we remember them today for their nightclubs. C. Ferguson had a nightclub called the Cotton Club, and I believe the Trianon Ballroom, that were pretty influential. But the main club and the one that was the most significant in the history of Indiana Avenue was Denver Ferguson's Sunset Terrace, which opened in the 1940s. And Denver Ferguson was not just a club owner. He was also an agent and a talent scout. And he brought to Indiana Avenue literally the greatest jazz and R&B musicians in world history, right? Like Duke Ellington made his debut on Indiana Avenue at Sunset Terrace. The first rock and roll concerts in Indiana were held at the Sunset Terrace. Little Richard played there in, I believe, 1954. Fats Domino played there in 1952. So the Sunset Terrace, I mean, name a major jazz or R&B figure from the mid-century, and they played there. You know, from the Fletcher Henderson Band to Ella Fitzgerald to any of these, Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, all these fantastic artists played there. So this was the main club that really brought the greatest musicians in the world to Indiana Avenue, and folks on the street could see it close up, and that was influencing the music that they were creating, the local musicians, because they had this access to see these groundbreaking bands, Cab Calloway, Dizzy Gillespie, you know, anybody you could name, Muddy Waters, people from all genres.
So Sunset Terrace opened in the 40s. Yep. Would you say it was by the late 40s into the early 50s that Indiana Avenue really started to find its voice musically? Or did it come before that and Sunset Terrace just came around at the right time?
You know, I think it started before that. I think you have to go back to the 1920s, you know, at the dawn of recorded music, where the sound was getting documented and being exported outside of Indianapolis. You know, we only have a limited insight on what happened before the commercial recording era really took off in the 1920s. So in the 1920s, you have a blues duo, Leroy Carr and Scrapper Blackwell, that really revolutionized blues music in ways that reverberated into, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even continue today. They had a style unlike any other performers of that era. Leroy Carr was a pianist and really clever songwriter, and he sang in this real urban and cool, kind of laid-back way. And his accompanist, Scrapper Blackwell, just really changed the way, the role of the guitar in blues music. He was not playing chords. He was just playing these single string leads. And this music just had such an incredible effect on the evolution of American popular music. You know, Muddy Waters has cited Leroy Carr as being the artist that really got him to begin singing and playing guitar himself. So in the Mississippi Delta, they were listening to these, you know, recordings that were made here in Indianapolis in the 1920s, and that was influencing what Robert Johnson did. That was influencing what an artist like Leadbelly did in Texas. So yeah, even as far back as the 1920s, at the dawn of the recording era, the beginning of the rise of the recording era, you know, Indiana Avenue musicians were really impacting culture at the highest level.
We're talking to Kyle Long, the host of Cultural Manifesto on WFYI Indianapolis, our flagship station, and he is also the creator of the new show Echoes of Indiana Avenue, and we're talking about what that show is going to be. And so, as I just mentioned, Cultural Manifesto is your other show. I really love it. You have such a wealth of knowledge about these very local artists and this history. Of course, you don't just talk to local artists, but you do focus a lot on Indianapolis. And you've talked a lot about Indiana Avenue on that show, though it's certainly not all about Indiana Avenue. Was there something, and you mentioned the Spotify playlist that you created as well. I guess, when was the moment that you thought, I could do a whole show on Indiana Avenue?
Right. You know, that's a great question. And that Spotify moment was really, I guess it solidified the idea. But I'd been thinking about it for a while because I felt like, as you mentioned, you know, I focus on a lot of different themes on my radio program. And I'm very interested in music from all over the world. And I'm interested in the immigrant music culture here in the city. And, you know, I've interviewed local musicians from the Mexican-American community. And I've interviewed major stars in Mexican music like Gerardo Ortiz or, you know, Indian classical musicians like Zakir Hussain. So I have a real passion and excitement for sharing that music with our listeners. But what I was finding is that I was so drawn into this world of Indiana Avenue and meeting the musicians who are still here with us today and helping to document their work. I was so passionate about that, and I felt it was like my most important calling as a music journalist to get involved with the documentation of this culture because it had been so overlooked for so long in many regards. So it was just taking over my show. You know, you know, a great rap album would come out by a local rapper, and I'd want to go interview this person, but I'd be like, you know what? I already have this content lined up with these musicians from the Avenue. And I was just so passionate about it that it was taking over everything I did. So I kind of started to think that I needed a different outlet for this subject. So it would free me up to, you know, have the diversity of content that I really wanted to bring to Cultural Manifesto when I started it.
I love that nobody can see this, but I'm sure it won't come as a surprise to many. I'm white, but I've worked in Indianapolis for over 15 years. Why haven't I, or maybe people like me, heard much about this?
So, you know, we have to be very blunt and honest about this. Race has been a huge factor, not just race, racism has been a huge factor in the history of Indiana Avenue. Indiana Avenue existed because of the racist policies of segregation that were enacted by white people, white politicians against black people in Indianapolis and around the United States. So, you know, as our culture changed and the Civil Rights Act was passed and, you know, desegregation happened, those racist attitudes didn't disappear in people, you know. And I think the residue of centuries or decades of racism tainted white America's view of black culture. I don't think that's a controversial thing to say. And I think because of that racism and these sorts of biases, no matter how extraordinary this culture was, it just wasn't going to be acknowledged, appreciated, celebrated, recognized, and respected in the way it should be by the dominant white culture who was in power here in Indianapolis. So that's the sad legacy of Indiana Avenue, that, you know, all this brilliant music and art was created under the thumb of this horrible and just, you know, disgusting racism. So I hate to say it, but I think racism has played a large role in how we perceive the Avenue. You know, for a long time, the dominant sort of message that white people would communicate about the Avenue is that it was a wasteland of poverty and crime. You know, they might mention there were jazz clubs there too, but the real genius and beauty of this, I think, was unrecognized by white residents of Indiana for far too long.
Your show has a narrator. It's different from the format of Cultural Manifesto, yeah, where you're a host and it's kind of an interview show, but it's also kind of a feature show where you play music. Can you tell me about your narrator, Herman Slaughter?
Yeah, Herman Butch Slaughter, as he's known. His nickname is Butch, and that's how a lot of folks in the music community know him, as Butch. Herman was, he grew up on the Avenue. He was born in the Flanner House Homes neighborhood, went to Attucks School as a young man, and he's a performer himself. He's a musician. He founded a vocal group called the Words of Wisdom. They're very popular here in Indianapolis in the 1970s. They recorded for Lamp Records here locally. They toured with James Brown at one point. Herman has sung backup for Solomon Burke, the great Southern soul singer. He's performed with Curtis Mayfield. He has a really stunning and impressive, you know, resume as a performer with this group, the Words of Wisdom. And I met Herman, actually, of all places, at the public hospital here in Indianapolis. I met him randomly, and he recognized me and had been familiar with my work. This was about 5 years ago. And we did an interview together. I interviewed him about his accomplishments, and we just hit it off. And he became sort of a guest or co-producer of my show, Cultural Manifesto. He was working with me to identify people in the community that might be good guests and helping me arrange interviews and meet with these people. So he became essentially a co-producer of my show. And, you know, we just had such a great working relationship. And he's such a, you know, wonderful example of the Avenue that it made sense. It was just organic and natural that we would start working together on this project. And, yeah, he narrates the show and adds that voice of that presence of the Avenue in this very authentic way.
Got just about a minute left. How is this going to sound? What other shows would you compare it to as far as how it's structured?
That's a great question. And, you know, obviously folks around Indiana haven't maybe heard my show Cultural Manifesto. It'll have a similar tone. I could point to other NPR programs that people might be familiar with, Alt Latino or Afro Pop, which was a very popular show for many years. You know, it's going to have that blend of cultural commentary and music that made those shows so interesting.
Okay. Kyle
Long. I hope.
I will. And I cannot wait to hear it. Kyle Long is the creator and producer of the new show Echoes of Indiana Avenue, which can be heard on our flagship station, WFYI Indianapolis, Thursdays at 8, Sundays at 7 p.m. and as a podcast. He also hosts Cultural Manifesto, which you can hear Wednesdays at 8 o'clock. Kyle, I really can't wait to hear it. Thank you so much for your work and thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Matt. It's an honor to be on this program. I thank you. And I thank all the musicians from Indiana Avenue who have contributed to my work. And it's been, you know, the biggest honor of my career as a music journalist to have been part of this. So thank you so much.
Up next, what does COVID recovery look like for someone who was in the ICU? I talked to a reporter from Side Effects Public Media about one patient who made it out alive. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In.
Nobody knows on uptown, baby, like I do, do. Nobody knows on uptown, baby, like I do, do. If you will stop and listen, I will tell you a thing or two, two. When you get lonesome.
This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. We've all seen the numbers of deaths from the pandemic. I get a push notification every day on my phone from the local newspaper. It's a grim reminder of how deadly COVID-19 can be. But what about the patients who make it out of the ICU? What does their recovery process look like? Stephanie Whiteside is a reporter from Side Effects Public Media, and she looked into one case that had a happy ending. At least that's the short version of the story. But the longer story is a little more complicated. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
So first of all, I mean, was it hard to find somebody who would agree to talk to you about this?
It was surprisingly hard. I'd been wanting to do the story a couple of months before I actually got to it. We've had a fair number of COVID cases in our area, but just finding a patient who is willing to talk was hard. I've worked pretty closely with Southern Illinois Healthcare, our local hospital system, one of them, but pretty much the major one, to find someone. And it was just, people would say they were going to talk and then they would change their mind. And of course, people coming out of the hospital are, you know, it's a while before they're ready to talk, especially, if they've been on a ventilator, just physically, some of them barely have a voice when they're leaving the hospital.
So then how'd you find Karen, the subject of your story?
Well, so I did find her through our local hospital system. She was where she was treated. The PIO there put me in touch with her. And, Karen was really great. She was really willing to kind of open up and share her story. And then so was her daughter, who I talked to as well.
How did Karen find out she had COVID-19? What was that like?
Yeah, so she didn't actually think she had COVID. She had fallen and she thought that she'd broken a rib. And so she went to the doctor and they did a chest x-ray and she was running a temperature. So they sent her for a COVID test and it came back positive. So initially she wasn't even thinking that it was COVID at all.
And so then what was that like for her? I mean, how quickly did things progress from that point?
Pretty quickly. I asked her about, the waiting for the test results, because it took a couple days. And she said, actually, she'd started getting so sick that she didn't even really worry because she just didn't have the bandwidth to think about it.
And so then what did her battle with COVID-19 look like?
Well, she was sick. I'm not sure how long she was sick at home for before she went to the hospital. Cause she doesn't really quite remember well.
And then cognitive issues that's one of the things that happen to patients who get severe symptoms of COVID-19 as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not sure how much that is COVID specific. I know, when I've had a really bad flu, you know, it all kind of blurs together and you get better and you're just like, wow, I was really sick for a while there. So I think, you know, that can happen to anyone when they're really sick. But, you know, she was in the hospital for almost a month. 2 weeks of that were in the COVID ICU unit, and then another 2 weeks were doing inpatient rehabilitation.
Did you get to talk to any of the staff that worked with Karen?
Yeah, I talked to Casey, who was a nurse that she remembers particularly well. She talked about how Casey really helped her get through it because, of course, you know, she couldn't have any of her family there or anything. He said that her story isn't necessarily uncommon, but she just went downhill really quickly once she got in the hospital.
Did Karen end up needing a ventilator?
No, she didn't. They had discussed it, and, you know, that kind of worried her family. Her daughter said, you know, that was really when it kind of registered with her that this might not have a great outcome because the survival odds do go down a little bit if you get to the point of needing a ventilator. But at that point, Karen agreed to try treatment with convalescent plasma and remdesivir. She was actually the first patient in this hospital system to do so, and she didn't end up needing a ventilator.
What did you learn then about her recovery process? Once those treatments happened, how quickly did things turn around? And then when was she let out?
Yeah, so she left the hospital at the end of June. She was really very weak. She said she had trouble even just sitting up in bed at the point when she, you know, kind of started to come back to herself in the hospital. And, you know, Karen was a home health aide. Her job is pretty physical. She is in her 60s, but she was in, you know, good health, physically active before she got sick. And she just said, you know, she never expected that she wouldn't be in a position of needing help to sit up or needing a walker.
And then, so how does her recovery compare to the recovery of, I don't know, other COVID survivors that where it got so bad that they needed to be hospitalized? Was her case pretty typical?
I think so. You know, it's hard to tell, but looking at it, there's a lot of reporting on people with long recovery periods, even outside of the COVID long haulers with ongoing symptoms. Just because being in an ICU or being on a ventilator takes so much out of you. You're basically inactive for that time, right? You're just lying in bed. Your muscles and everything aren't getting used the way they would. And as when I talked to Karen in August, she was going to be in outpatient therapy at least through September, and she still didn't know if she was going to be able to go back to work.
Okay, and so you talked to her in August, and so I don't know if you followed up with her since then, but the last you spoke with her, how was she doing? I mean, did she seem to be doing okay?
Yeah, she's a really optimistic person, and she's got a great sense of humor. I know when she talked about first getting sick, she said, you know, I was really out of my head, and I just didn't want to eat. And my daughter came, and she would keep trying to get me to eat. She said, I just kept saying no thank you. I was really nice about it, but I didn't want to do it. Like I said, she still hadn't made the decision about going back to work. I know she wants to. Her daughter doesn't necessarily want her to go back out after that scare, but she wasn't using a walker anymore. And so just really working on getting her strength back.
So after the fact, when you talked to her daughter, Kenley, what did she say about this whole thing?
It wasn't initially in my plans, but I talked to Karen and, you know, it became clear she didn't remember some of the things from when she was really sick. And so her daughter, Kenley, who lived with her, was really able to help fill in the gaps. But it was hard for her, too. She also had COVID, though she just had a mild case. But what struck me the most was how, you know, close it could have been. She ended up taking Karen to the emergency room after she was having trouble breathing. But Kenley noticed that because she had set an alarm to wake up at 4 a.m. and check on her mom. And she said, you know, if she wasn't the type of person to do that, or if she hadn't been living with her mom and it had been just, you know, kind of going by to check on her, Karen might have died just because there wouldn't have been anybody to get her to the hospital, which was just, that hit me really hard.
And so Karen, thankfully, didn't need to be on a ventilator, but did you find anything about what it's like to be on a ventilator and what it does to the body?
Yeah. So when I was doing this story, before I found Karen, I'd started talking to some different folks at the hospitals. And I talked to a respiratory therapist and speech therapist who has worked with patients that have been in ICU on ventilators. And she said, if you're intubated and on a ventilator for more than 48 hours, there's much more of a chance of having issues with recovering. And COVID patients are, of course, as I'm sure a lot of people have read, often on a ventilator for days or even weeks. Mm. And so that increases the risk of aspirating into the lungs and makes it harder for them. She talked about people having to really even just relearn how to swallow and to eat even liquids and then solid food, because being on a ventilator just can make you, I guess, lose that ability.
So how many patients had this hospital seen, and how many of them ended up being hit hard enough that they needed a ventilator?
I want to say this is actually the data I have is for the entire hospital system, SIH. So that actually covers three hospitals that are all under the same umbrella. And this is data as of September 14th, so it may have changed, but they had seen 177 patients hospitalized with COVID, and 28 of them had required intubation. So, you know, a lot of them didn't, as you can tell from that. So that's good. And they did also say, I thought it was interesting, although the average age of their COVID patients was 65, they had seen patients as young as 18 and as old as 102.
Wow. Stephanie Whiteside is a reporter for Side Effects Public Media, which is a public health news collaborative based out of our flagship station, WFYI in Indianapolis. Stephanie, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
And now a little about the Gloria Barron Prize for Young Heroes, which honors outstanding young leaders ages 8 to 18 who have made a significant positive difference to people and the environment. One of this year's winners is from Fort Wayne. Sammy Vance is 11 years old, and she joins us now. Hi, Sammy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what'd you do to win this prize?
So when I was 8 years old, I started the Buddy Bench Project for my school. We did it in a unique way because we collected plastic caps and lids to get it, 400 pounds at the time, just to get 1 6-foot buddy bench. And I thought that it was going to take about a year, but with the whole community's help, we ended up getting about 3 buddy benches and 2 months and
wow.
Extra caps too. Yeah, so... And then it, like, spread from there, and I'm super happy that the word is getting out and more friends are being made.
Well, what is a buddy bench for?
A buddy bench is a place for when someone is lonely, they can sit on the buddy bench, and another person can come up to them and ask them to play, and they can play together. So it's a signal for other kids to know that the person sitting on the bench is lonely and in need of a friend.
Where'd you hear about buddy benches? How'd you get this idea?
I heard about the Buddy Bench Project at a summer camp, and I thought it was a great idea because I knew that I needed it and so many other kids needed it too.
Oh, so if your school had a buddy bench, you would have used it then?
Yeah.
I guess you had to bring some people on board with this. I guess your principal, you had to convince them what they think.
Yeah, so my principal thought it was a great idea, and we decided to shoot for 1 in a year. But like I said, we ended up getting 3 and 2 months with extra caps. So, yeah, we got a lot more people on board than we thought we would, but it's awesome because the word is being spread.
And I guess the company that makes these benches is also in Indiana too, right?
Yeah, Evansville, Indiana. Green Tree Plastic is one that has helped me a lot because they're the ones that make the magic happen because they actually make the buddy benches.
So these benches are made out of recycled caps. Do you know why they use mostly plastic caps and lids and not other things?
Yeah, they use plastic caps instead of like water bottles and stuff because they could still cause a lot of harm to the environment and stuff. So they wanted to find a way that they can help the environment. So they decided to take plastic caps and lids to do it.
So this caught fire. You collected enough caps to make 3 benches in 2 months. You were hoping to make 1 bench a year. I don't know. How did that word get out? I mean, how did that idea sort of go viral, I guess?
Yeah, I drew a comic and just explaining how the buddy bench worked. My mom posted it on Facebook and I think the word just got around from there. And then I started posting videos and encouraging other people to do it too.
And so then these caps started coming in from just all over town, or were you getting people from like outside of the state who were helping out too?
Yeah.
I mean, how far did this reach?
So I got at least one cap from all 50 states. And yeah, I got caps from outside of the country, which is pretty awesome because the word is really being spread, knowing that to help the environment and to have more friends being made. The word has really gotten around. And yeah, I'm happy about that.
So these first three benches, did they just go to your school, or are you sending them elsewhere too, these first three?
Yeah, so the three benches we got from my school. There was two for the playground and one for up front of the school. And then I've helped donate other benches with the help of Walgreens and UPS.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, okay. So let's jump into that. So you were recently on the Today Show to talk about this. What was that like?
Yeah, so about, I think, 2 years ago I was on the Today Show.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember, but yeah. And they announced Walgreens was going to be helping collect caps for the summer to help get buddy benches. And it was amazing because they ended up collecting enough for 75 buddy benches.
Oh, my goodness. Where are those going?
Those went all around Indiana to a bunch of different schools.
So these benches are going all around Indiana. They're made in Indiana. And Walgreens is helping you out big time. But if other people want to help out, what can they do?
Yeah, so if anyone wants to help, that would be amazing. Really, the main thing is if there's a school or a park or something collecting nearby, or you want to just save a stash of caps like we do. We have like a stash of caps at our house that we always collect. If there's like a school, or get a school involved with it and have them maybe collect caps, because it's a really good community project. We had the whole community help, which was pretty awesome. That's how we got them so fast, because I would not have been able to do that on my own. I can assure you that. But yeah, so just start collecting caps.
Yeah. How old were you when you started this project?
I was 8 years old going into third grade.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, okay. And here you are, 11 years. Are you headed into middle school? Are you in middle school?
I'm in middle school, yeah.
Okay.
Now I'm in middle school, yep.
So how did you find out about this Gloria Barron Prize? How were you nominated?
Yeah, so I applied, and I had some other people like also submitted to that too, so yeah.
So then when you won the prize, I mean, did that get you even more attention? Obviously, it got my attention. That's why we're talking right now. So have you seen like a big increase in the number of caps, or has that number been big ever since you were on the Today Show?
Yeah, I guess the number has really been big, because every once in a while I'll just get a big box of caps and I'm like, wow, this is from a new place. So, yeah.
Does that ever get, I don't know, overwhelming? Like, do you have bags full of caps in your garage, or do you have a place where you keep them all?
Yeah, we do have a lot of caps in our basement, but we donate them a lot to different places that are collecting. So, yeah, it doesn't get, like, too overwhelming in our basement.
So how do you then get them? Because you're in Fort Wayne. How do you then get them all the way across the state down to Evansville? Do you take them yourself, or do you have a partnership to do that?
Yeah, so we took them down ourselves when we went to get the buddy benches.
The first three.
And I think, yeah, that's what most people do, or they have it shipped to them.
Do you know if this idea is catching anywhere else based on your inspiration, I guess?
Well, I think mainly across the U.S., some places, which I didn't start this project to get awards or anything, but I'm happy I did, because it gets the word out. It lets other people know, to include people and to help save the environment.
Sammy Vance is from Fort Wayne, and she founded Sammy's Buddy Bench Project. And for that, she was one of this year's winners for the Gloria Barron Prize for Young Heroes. That's got a nice ring to it, Sammy. Congratulations. Thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Find our podcast wherever you get podcasts. Go back in the archive, see if you missed anything. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana for topic alerts and discussion. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.